This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, a $1.1 trillion omnibus government spending bill is on its way to the president's desk with a slew of riders attached. EU leaders call for regional border patrol and Coast Guard forces, and we'll visit a hackathon in South Los Angeles designed to introduce coding skills to kids without computers. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. U.S. lawmakers hopscotch their way to avoiding a government shutdown this week. As has become part of the routine, a slew of special interest riders were tacked onto the massive 2,000-page omnibus must-pass spending bill. Among them, a GOP-favored $622 billion in tax cuts. That measure further delays taxes designed to fund the Affordable Care Act. Just before the Friday House vote on the spending bill, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California introduced the Puerto Rico Emergency Financial Stability Act and tried to force the chamber to take action on the bill after members had scuttled the issue from earlier budget debates.
Puerto Rico urgently needs this respite while Congress considers restructuring legislation to provide the 3.5 million U.S. citizens that call Puerto Rico home the tools they need to comprehensively address the territory's unsustainable debt burden.
But Pelosi was shut down on parliamentary grounds. Immediately thereafter, the Speaker called the vote on the $1.1 trillion funding bill.
On this vote, the yeas are 316, the nays are 113.
A procedural voice vote followed.
The second portion of the divided question is adopted. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
With that, the massive spending bill now goes to the Senate, where it is expected to pass. Analysts say President Obama is likely to sign the measure that includes another $80 billion in tax cuts. One rider expands the H-2B visa program that would nearly triple the number of foreign workers admitted to the country to fill non-agricultural, low-wage jobs. And a modified version of the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act was slipped into the bill under the radar. Digital rights advocates say this version strips what little privacy protections were in the legislation the Senate passed earlier this year, making it a de facto bill to expand surveillance. But many of the riders Republicans sought to attach failed. One of those would have killed the Waters of the United States rule, also known as WOTUS, or the Clean Water Rule. WOTUS is designed to expand the 1972 Clean Water Act to include smaller bodies of water, like streams, tributaries, marshes, and wetlands. But the WOTUS fight isn't over and will likely reemerge in the coming year. FSRN's Hannah Lee Myers has more.
While I agree that the Clean Water Act needs clarified, this rule would drastically expand federal jurisdiction beyond the historical limits of the law.
That was Representative Glenn Thompson of Pennsylvania speaking to Congress Wednesday about Waters of the United States, or WOTUS. He argued the rule will impede farming operations nationwide and is an unnecessary overstep of federal authority. Supporters of WOTUS say the rule will better protect 2 million miles of streams, tens of millions of acres of wetlands, and drinking water used by businesses and 117 million Americans. Jin Verviers is Director of Sustainability and Strategy at New Belgium Brewing Company in Fort Collins, Colorado. As a WOTUS supporter and staffer at a company that depends on high-quality water, Verviers cites EPA data saying the Clean Water Rule will provide around $340 million, and maybe much more, in annual benefits to the public and the business sector. She encourages those concerned about the short-term hassles of WOTUS regulation to look at the big picture.
You know, the free market is excellent at allocating most resources, but it's really not capable of valuing something like a stream that flows into something that flows into our drinking water. And that's what government is for, and that's what regulation does, is protect our mutual resources for the long term. And I think progressive, forward-thinking businesses are in support of that.
Since the Obama administration, the EPA, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued the Clean Water Rule in May, many influential interests in the agricultural sector have come out against it, saying WOTUS would unnecessarily complicate basic farming operations, like dealing with irrigation water. The American Farm Bureau Federation and its Colorado counterpart are perhaps the most outspoken opponents to WOTUS. They argue that the Clean Water Act, as is, already sufficiently protects American waters. And as farmers, they do care about long-term water protection.
We depend on high-quality water for our livelihoods.
That's Brent Boydston, Vice President for Public Policy for the Colorado Farm Bureau. He says ambiguous wording in the Clean Water Rule could give the EPA regulatory control over massive swaths of private land across the country, including areas that only gather water temporarily after heavy rains. And that ambiguous language is the primary reason for concern.
EPA Administrator McCarthy got called to a hearing in front of Congress, and there was a member of Congress who held up a picture, and it was of a water standing in the field, and this congressman asked very bluntly, would this be jurisdictional? And Administrator McCarthy came back and said, well, we can't really tell from the picture if it would be jurisdictional or not. Well, after a few minutes, she came back and said, well, we can tell you that it's not jurisdictional. So how on one hand can she say from a picture that something's not jurisdictional when she couldn't say a few minutes before looking at the same picture, she couldn't make a determination at all? So that, in my opinion, really, really illustrated how much the ambiguity allows for the whims of the EPA to determine what is and what is not jurisdictional water.
In October, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit issued a nationwide preliminary injunction blocking WOTUS from going into effect until the courts can determine if the rule is lawful. Last week, the Sixth Circuit heard oral arguments over which court should handle challenges to the Clean Water Rule. Mark Squillaci, a professor of law at the University of Colorado and former director of the Natural Resources Law Center, says he disagrees that the Clean Water Rule's language is any more ambiguous than terminology used in the original Clean Water Act. Squillaci adds that, like the Clean Power Plan and Clean Air Rule, the Clean Water Rule issue has become a partisan sticking point.
As we've seen this whole thing play out, they're very political questions. I think it's sort of unfortunate because, it's an important issue for protecting our water supplies and, you know, just how we're going to do that. But because it's been so politicized, it would not surprise me at all if the Supreme Court decided to take this.
Adding to the controversy is a report issued this week by the Government Accountability Office, which determined the EPA misused its social media accounts when drumming up support for the Clean Water Rule. Again, Representative Glenn Thompson of Pennsylvania speaking to Congress Wednesday.
In its finding, the GAO said that this was an attempt by the EPA to spread, quote, covert propaganda, end quote, by directing Internet users to the websites of environmental groups in support of the WOTUS rule. This illegal attempt to gain congressional support for the rule and to sway public opinion undermines the integrity of the rulemaking process, and it shows just how unprecedented this vast expansion of the EPA's power really is.
But technically, that infraction won't slow WOTUS's implementation. At this point, WOTUS is still facing serious challenges from both the legislative and judicial branches. A resolution to kill WOTUS has passed in the Senate and is likely to pass in the House, with Obama promising to veto. Within the judiciary, the process of appeals and court rulings is predicted to move slowly, with some law analysts saying we might not get a final ruling on the Waters of the United States rule until 2017. Hanalei Myers, FSRN, Denver.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News. For information about tax-deductible year-end contributions, visit our website, fsrn.org. Friday is International Migrants Day, with candlelight vigils scheduled around the world to remember the more than 5,000 people who died during the past year while fleeing war and poverty in their homelands. Many perished while trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea en route to Europe, where some nations are more accommodating than others. Now EU leaders in Brussels are mulling a Europe-wide border force and Coast Guard. The proposal both raises sovereignty issues and alarms rights groups, who caution Europe not to militarize its borders and leave human rights to play second fiddle. FSRN's Jacob Rasnak reports.
This week, the European Union unveiled a plan to create a European Border and Coast Guard Agency with a 1,500-strong rapid reaction force at its command. European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans said the new force would be available to intervene when a member state itself was unable to control its own borders.
In such rare cases, the agency itself must be able to quickly step in and assume the management of that specific part of the shared external border.
That's far from hypothetical. Greece and Italy have for months been overwhelmed by the tens of thousands of migrants arriving by land and sea, mostly by sea, escaping the war-torn Middle East and poverty and criminality in Africa. Patrols by national coast guards have rescued tens of thousands crossing in small dinghies, yet more than 3,600 people have died this year trying to cross the Mediterranean. The plan is controversial as the new border agency would answer to Brussels and not be beholden to the governments of the countries where it would operate. Even as the European Migration Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos assured the European Parliament that member states' sovereignty would be respected, he left no question who would have the final say.
The agency will be empowered to require member states to take corrective measures. The decisions of the agency will be binding for the member states.
That will certainly lead to a sovereignty debate between countries nervous about having a paramilitary force on its soil, but not under its command. Poland, Sweden, and Greece have already expressed reservations. The proposal also comes amid documented rights violations of refugees at the hands of national authorities, and so far this plan does little to address that. Maria Serrano is with Amnesty International's European Institutions Office in Brussels.
There are a lot of abuses that are happening at the borders, and there wasn't any accountability at all. So what we would like to see is respect for the right to asylum at the borders, but also accountability, because human rights violations for the moment remain unchallenged and under impunity.
The new agency would also have an arm dedicated to stepping up deportations of those who fail to qualify for asylum. The border proposal comes on the heels of the EU granting $3.2 billion to Turkey to stem the outflow of migrants, mostly Syrians and Iraqis. Those numbers have fallen, but Amnesty International has also documented rights violations by Turkish security forces, which have rounded up refugees and deported them to active war zones in Syria and Iraq. A final decision on the new border agency isn't expected until later this month. In the meantime, the winter weather has not dampened the determination of tens of thousands of people making the journey, seeking safety and a better life. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Bonn.
As Europe continues to debate how to craft a unified policy for migrants and refugees, a milestone in U.S. immigration policy came and went with little reflection. This week marked 10 years since Operation Streamline took effect. The policy criminalizes what used to be a civil offense, illegal entry and re-entry into the United States. The shift ushered in a practice of mass criminal trials for immigration offenses and has been a windfall for privately run immigration detention centers. Bethany Carson is the immigration policy researcher and organizer at Grassroots Leadership in Austin, Texas.
You know, the stated goal was to deter migration, and that has not happened. These prosecutions criminalize people who are coming to reunite with their families, to seek asylum, to economically sustain themselves and their families. And for the reasons that people come, they're not going to be deterred by prison sentences. And speaking with federal public defenders, they will tell you that they see people come back again and again. And this is also a policy that has funneled people into for-profit federal prisons that are segregated prisons specifically for immigrants with worse conditions, the rationale being that they don't want to spend money on people who are not going to be coming back into American society and will be deported afterwards. So this has also dramatically increased the proportion of Latinos in the federal prison system. And also, illegal entry and reentry charges are now the two top criminal charges being filed in our federal court system. Together, they form nearly 50% of the entire cases filed for prosecution. And this should be incredibly troubling in our current political environment that is actually working to end mass incarceration across bipartisan lines.
Prison sentences for illegal reentry under Operation Streamline can range up to 20 years. The program began in the Del Rio sector of the Texas border, but later expanded to Yuma, Arizona, Laredo, Texas, and eventually to all southern border sectors, except those in California. Dow and DuPont have announced plans for a $130 billion mega merger. The merger is expected to take place in the second half of 2016, after which the parent company will break into three firms. One of them will focus specifically on agriculture. Dow and DuPont are already among a small group of companies that control both an overwhelming amount of the world's seed supply and the production of chemicals used in the fields. For more on what the merger could mean for agriculture, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch.
Dow and DuPont are household names when it comes to chemical production, but they also control a significant chunk of the world's seed supply. What are the primary implications of this merger for global agriculture?
So agriculture is already very consolidated, and the seeds and the chemicals a lot of farmers use to grow seeds were already marketplaces with have a lot of control in just a couple of hands. And so you'll often hear, if you're talking about GMO seeds, genetically engineered seeds, often they're genetically engineered to work with specific chemicals like weed killers, herbicides. And it's chemical companies who make those herbicides who are selling the GMO seeds, and they sell them together as a package deal. And you'll hear about the big six. So with this deal, we would go from the big six chemical and seed companies to big five.
And who exactly are the big six?
So some of them are names people have heard of, like Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, and then his other chemical companies, Bayer, Syngenta, BASF.
So in size and scope, would this merger make Dow, DuPont comparable to Monsanto?
Yes. And so some estimates we've seen, you know, that we have to see the details of the deal, but from some of the reporting about what they're saying about this merger, that in terms of selling seeds, this new Dow DuPont would be bigger. There's a lot of crazy business practices that go on in the world of genetic engineering. Monsanto owns a lot of the intellectual property, the patents of those GMO traits, but Dow might actually sell more seeds after this deal. It just might have Monsanto traits in those seeds. They do a lot of licensing with each other.
You touched on this earlier, but can you explain a bit more about how closely chemicals and seeds are tied up in patented technology bundles?
Sure. So the business model doesn't get talked about as much in the PR and the hype about GMO seeds. There's a lot of, you know, social good that the marketing for GMOs talks about how they're going to solve that problem. The real net effect of GMOs at this point has been in packaging seeds for commodity crops like corn and soybeans and canola with specific chemical technologies that these companies were already making. So the main trait historically that has been put in GMO crops is that they're Roundup ready. You can grow the crop, plant the seed, grow the crop, spray the whole field with Roundup weed killer, which is a product made by Monsanto, and they genetically engineered seeds to withstand that. And so you're going to sell the Roundup ready seed and the Roundup together. Dow is in on the action. They've gotten different things approved that are 2,4-D ready. So 2,4-D is a really infamous herbicide. It was in the mix of herbicides that were called Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. So there's 2,4-D ready crops that are going to come onto the market at some point. So this is the business model of GMOs, is to sell more of those chemicals by making the seeds work with them and then packaging the two together.
Is what you're describing an issue specifically with GMOs, or is it also the case with patented hybrid seeds that aren't necessarily genetically engineered?
So these are companies that sell a lot of seeds. So the real blockbusters that they push, you know, especially for the kind of the commodity crops, corn, soybeans, you know, cotton, canola, they are pushing GMOs very, very hard. And we hear all the time from farmers, it's hard to find the seeds they want, the varieties they want that haven't been genetically engineered. But these seed companies also own lots of non-GMO crops as well, and they just have a lot of control generally of seeds. So after this merger, people are estimating that the combined DowDuPont would control 38% of the sales of soybean seeds and over 40% of the sales of corn seeds, and that's one company. So for farmers, that's going to give them even less choices in a market that's already consolidated.
Do you see any raising of antitrust concerns or other pushback at the regulatory level when it comes to questioning this merger? Or is it pretty much being treated as a done deal at this point?
So we haven't entered that phase yet. The companies have just publicly said, yes, we're going to merge, and they do have to file things with the government. So we'll see. The one thing we do know is that this part of the food system, the seed sector of agriculture, is already on the government's radar as being very consolidated. In 2010, the USDA and the Department of Justice did hearings around the country on the state of competition. Basically, do we have enough competition in the agriculture system? And they had one of those events in Iowa, and almost the whole day was about seeds. And supposedly there was an investigation at that point actually into Monsanto, you know, the peer of these two companies, and their practices and whether there were antitrust concerns. Nothing came out of that investigation, but there was enough worry there to do it. So this is a sector we already know is too consolidated. So we're going to push on the Department of Justice, and everybody else needs to as well, to say you have to look into this. This is not a good deal for anybody but these two companies.
Patty Lovera is the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
Despite years of policy debate about how to narrow the divide between digital haves and have-nots, the problem persists. The gap is also now apparent in the lack of diversity in workforces at major tech companies. Last year, Google reported that only 2% of their employees are Black, 3% are Latino. Diversity demographics are almost exactly the same at Facebook and Twitter. And at all three companies, Black and Latino employees often work in janitorial services. An analysis conducted by USA Today found that Black and Latino computer science and engineering students are graduating from top-tier schools at twice the rate that they're hired by leading tech companies. But FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports that instead of being discouraged by those numbers, a Los Angeles nonprofit is one of many that's not giving up, and they have no doubt that the demand for knowledge and computers is there, even if the resources are not.
Do you have a computer at home?
No. No. No.
That makes me sad.
This casual poll of Latino and African American middle and high school students in South Los Angeles is far from scientific, but for Oscar Menavar, it's heartbreaking.
So I grew up in Watts, and it makes me sad that, you know, in 1996, I didn't have a computer. And I went to college without having been able to touch a computer and still did computer information system. And then kids in 2015 still don't have computers at home, and they're not having access to really understanding this is really their future jobs.
Menavar is the CEO and founder of TXT, Teens Exploring Technology, a nonprofit that helps inner-city kids learn technology and entrepreneurial skills. Just 6 months ago, Menavar conducted his own informal survey of 135 students in South Los Angeles and found that a scant 5% of them had internet access at home. The Pew Research Center found that less than 40% of households with an annual income of $25,000 or less have internet access at home, compared to 85% in households with incomes ranging from $50,000 to $100,000.
You write your team name down, and you go ahead and just bring that up to the front here, and we will register.
Menavar is trying to narrow that digital divide, and so are the Latino and African-American kids gathered inside the crowded gym of a city rec room in South Los Angeles on a recent sunny weekend. The kids came out for an event called the Hustle and Code South LA Hackathon.
We're helping kids understand how code can change their communities, and they're doing that by learning how to code and designing products or ideas that are going to address a social issue in South LA. So we recruited most kids who come from the public housing, Los Pueblos public housing, so that's where they're coming from. You know, and just bringing access not just to technology and the internet, but access to coding literature and access to coding education, educational.
Darnese, a soft-spoken 11-year-old, sits at a table at the back of the room. She already knows the story she wants her coding skills to tell. On the screen in front of her are three young ladies hanging out.
I'm going to make them, like, talk with each other, and then one of them going to start singing, and then like, two best friends are going to clap for her and then tell her that she should be on a stage to sing. And they should be her backup singers.
12-year-old Darion, who sports a black and blonde frohawk, flexes his coding skills at the front of the room. He's creating a website designed to help the less fortunate.
Helping the homeless on, like, clothes, getting them a job, something, shelter, and other things as well. We're making our own little website.
He clearly enjoys every moment at the computer, and he says he and his friends who came with him are having fun. Darnese and Darion are among those who could not be doing these exercises at home. Neither one has a computer there.
It makes me a little depressed how I don't have one, and many people has one.
Many of the students at the event, including Darion and Darnese, came with the hopes of going home with their own computer. Four computers were up for grabs via raffle tickets earned through coding exercises. Google virtual reality cardboard glasses were also among the giveaways.
All right, first, 889-2934. 889-2934. 889-2934.
A number of volunteers donated their time for the event, helping with everything from tutoring to serving lunch. Maritza Mendez started volunteering with TXT 3 years ago.
The growth, it's exponential. Like, we had, it's significantly grown so much. Our first hackathon, I would say there was probably, I would say, like, maybe 30 students at the time, and I mean, I just arrived here, but this auditorium looks pretty full right now.
Studies show that staff at major tech companies are overwhelmingly white, Asian, and male. That includes Google, one of the sponsors of the event, and Apple, the brand of computer brought in for the coding session. Both corporations say they are seeking to hire a more inclusive workforce. Menavar, who immigrated as a child from El Salvador, says he's seen firsthand the lack of diversity in the tech field, but it does not faze him. Rather, it motivates him to prove the potential of the kids of South Los Angeles.
I'll be very honest. The tech companies won't be able to keep up with us as soon as we get our hands into more coding.
And he says the next time around, he hopes to hold the event not in a rec room, but at the L.A. Convention Center. The turnout and growth of these events and the clear enthusiasm of the participants show that the bigger challenge is one of access.
Come on up, come on up.
Lana Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find downloadable audio and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is Boogie Belgique via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.